I grew up in a family in on the North Shore of Auckland. Both my mum and dad were teachers. My mum was a school teacher, and my dad was a civil engineer, but taught civil engineering at the Auckland Technical Institute. And so there was time for the kids, and there were four children in the family. Whenever anybody showed the slightest aptitude for music, or the slightest interest in anything, like my parents would race out and organise the lesson or the membership of the club or whatever it was. And so I was interested in music, and I could sing in tune, and I was very keen to be the centre of attention right from a very early age. And so my dad would buy or rent bits and pieces of old musical instruments, and there were lots of them lying around the house as I was growing up. And I think I started learning cello and piano when I was about seven, and then gradually added more instruments to that. Went through the tune a day for whatever instrument it was, for just about every instrument, I think. By the time I was about 14, I suppose, I was playing in a youth orchestra, and I was writing songs, and I was starting to get interested in bands. There was some sort of nightclub bands that were formed out of some of the more dangerous looking guys at the school that I was at, and that was really attractive. The idea of basking in some of their reflected danger was that was pretty exciting. So I did that. I sort of joined. I had a residency playing keyboards in a band when I was about 15. This band was billed as the loudest band on the shore. The promoter of the venue couldn't bring himself to say anything about the quality of what we were doing, but it was like the loudest band on the shore. So we were that we lasted in that for about, I think, about 3 years, during which time I was still studying the French horn. By that stage, I'd started to learn the French horn. I was really keen to play that in an orchestra. I carried on sort of following those sort of two strands of learning how to write songs, learning how to be in a band, learning all the sort of extra musical stuff that you have to learn. And on the other side, I was learning the French horn. I had a really cool teacher who would sit me down and make me listen to Bruckner and Mahler, make me listen to stuff which is sort of the really romantic end of music, the kind of stuff that sort of makes you punch the air with your fist. It's so exciting, and that's the way to sort of come into that kind of music, I suppose, especially if you're a French horn player. About second year of university, I was really good friends with a group of people that was sort of centred by Richard von Sturmer and Charlotte Wrightson, and they're both writers and performers. They started a group called Inside Information, which was sort of a music theatre collective. I joined in on that, and I ended up throwing song ideas into the pot. We did shows around Auckland. Richard was a really prolific writer. He still is. He writes. He's more working with his poetry and short stories, I believe, at the moment. But in those days, he would churn out lyrics all written with this old typewriter, and everything written in capitals, and all the lines are really short, and they're all really sort of political diatribes. He had a song called Frank Gill's an Idiot, and Frank Gill used to be an MP. It just repeated that over and over again, and a lot of these songs were arranged and performed by Richard's band, The Plague, which is a really notorious band around Auckland. Was quite famous for shows where the whole front line of the band would be naked and painted different colours. And I played with them a few times while I was actually in the Symphonia. So occasionally I'd come from Symphonia gigs still in my Symphonia penguin suit with my French horn, and I'd stand up on stage with them, and the naked painted people would jump around me. We'd play these play songs like Frank Gill's an Idiot and Private Property, and there, it was a really vicious noise, but it was really fun to be part of. Three of the members of that group floated off to form another group called the Whiz Kids, which was a more probably more conventional rock and roll band. So the Whiz Kids travelled around the country being a band and made a record and did all the things that bands do. I was a member of that for the last year, I think, playing saxophone and guitar. None of which I could play very well, but it seemed like a good thing to do. And I sort of didn't really want to finish my university degree, so I was kind of a bit at a loss at that stage. That group broke up in about 1980, late 1980, I think it was, and the remains of it was Blam Blam Blam. Mark Bell, Tim Mahon, and myself. I had done quite a bit of percussion, but I hadn't really been a drummer ever. I could read music and play orchestral percussion, but I couldn't really join all the hands and feet together. But I figured I could do it. I figured it wasn't very difficult. And the whole punk ethic of trying to deny technical ability as much as you could, you know, trying to if you could actually play an instrument, then make sure that's not the one you play in the band. And that really suited us. Although you know, deep down we were really interested in music. Like we probably used more outlandish chords and more angular melodies and more interesting rhythms than a lot of the other bands were using at that time. But the basic impetus was that kind of breath of fresh air that was blowing through pop music and that blew away the Eagles and the Doobie Brothers and all that horrible stuff that we had to grow up with and all that horrible stuff that we had to that served as the backdrop for our first dates in cars all the way through the 70s. So that was great. That was a wonderful time being in that band. It was just brilliant. There were only three of us. Musically, we were moving really fast. We were learning stuff all the time, and every time we made up a new song, sparks were flying, and it was a wonderful thing to be in. And I think we made some good records and did some really good shows with that band. There's a song called Call for Help, which is one of the first ones I wrote for Blam Blam Blam. It's a piece about, I suppose it's about fear of the unknown in the countryside, and I didn't know where it came from. It was sort of came from a dream, and it proved to be it's like the first of a whole series of songs like that I've done. I still don't know really where they come from, but it seems to be it's a recurring dream that then wants to be made into a song, and I've made quite a few songs like that with the Front Lawn, with the Mutton Birds. But Call for Help was sort of like the blueprint for it. There were lots of Blam 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 songs that were really, really fun to do and really fun to play to people for the first time because you could feel that we were different. We knew we were different. And, when the first time we played this Don't Fight at Marsha, It's Bigger Than Both of Us, to on a Students' Arts Council tour of New Zealand, you know, to have what's essentially a loud, thrashy band suddenly put down their instruments and to turn on a weedy little drum machine and play this very, very still piece of music, this rather strange, ironic idea. We didn't quite know why it was good, but we knew it was good. When I left Blam Blam Blam, the first thing I did was I went to Australia to tour Australia with From Scratch. I was really unsure of writing, of being the centre of attention, I suppose. It was really getting to me, the idea that I had kind of turned into a writer, and I really didn't know what to do with that status. There were other things floating around at the time. From Scratch I'd already done some work with From Scratch. You know, it was kind of attractive to sort of slot into someone else's big idea, and to be to have a role that I could understand, a role that was manageable, and to have the opportunity to go somewhere else, get out of this place, learn things, and and I really needed that. From Scratch was the brainchild of Philip Dadson, who's a composer who lectures in sculpture at Elam, Auckland Auburn Art School. It was in those days, and it still is, because the group's still going. It's essentially it's a kind of performance that's based on a really thoroughgoing idea, an idea that dictates how the music's going to be written step by step, how the instruments are going to be laid out in the space, how the performers are going to come into the space, what they're going to do in the space before the instruments are laid out. It's the nature of it is organic. I mean, it's a very simple idea, the idea of balance, the idea of circularity, the idea of equality of parts. And if you take that right down to musical composition, if you're working with balance, then you're working with, say, rhythms that where you play the same number of notes on your left hand as you play on your right hand. And then if you're looking at equality and equality of parts, that means that you're not going to have solos. You're going to have three people sharing roles, and also if you're looking at equality, a kind of democratic way of making music, then that lends itself to the idea of hocketing, which is where a group of people share a melody or a rhythm by each playing a little bit of it. Front Lawn was very much a grab bag of possibilities. And anything that we woke up in the morning thinking might get thrown into a piece would probably become a piece. It might be 1 minute long, and it might be a song, or it might be a little piece of dialogue, or it might be a completely mime thing. You know, anything could be in a Front Lawn piece, and that's completely opposed to the kind of rigorous. Rule-based, organic sort of quality that From Scratch had. So in some ways, the Front Lawn was kind of like a reaction against the strictures of being in From Scratch. It was the strangest thing, because we started off with quite high-flown. We started off taking ourselves terribly seriously in the rehearsal room. Quite high-flown ideas about culture and about men. You know, because we sat down facing each other saying, you know, what are we going to make pieces about? What have we got? You know, we're not oppressed. We're not minorities. You know, I mean, we come from good homes. We're talented. You know, we should just shut up, you know, really, because we're going to get good jobs at some stage. What have we got? We're men. That's right. You know, so quite often stuff would come out about men initially, I think this is terrible to admit to anybody, but initially I think we wanted to call ourselves the Y-Fronts, because it seemed that a lot of the ideas were to do with maleness. Thank heavens we didn't call ourselves the Y-Fronts. But anyway, we'd have these serious ideas. We'd make these pieces which didn't have punchlines, you know, and some of them were about mad. A lot of them were about madness. A lot of them were about what happens when you step outside of what's normal, you know, and what happens when your responses aren't appropriate. Is that the whole piece, the how you're doing dance, which we used to do. We'd take these quite serious ideas onto the stage, and people would laugh. People would just fall about, and it was quite a shock. I mean, we didn't know when we wrote all the stuff and we did the first tour, we had no idea that it was going to be funny, and that people were going to write reviews saying, you know, these two are rapidly becoming New Zealand's best loved silly goats. You know, I mean, we didn't want to be best loved silly goats. We were serious artists, you know. But we actually embraced that as well, I think, because we were learning on our feet. You know, we were making decisions as we went. I think most of the best stuff of what we did was just looking at very ordinary situations, looking at the rules and the rituals that make us who we are, and seeing in situations that you normally take for granted, the vastness of of being what it is to be human, like the enormity of what it is to be human, the huge landscape that's inside us and that's inside every gesture, you know, and most of that landscape's unknown. Some of it, there's little paths that we walk along with our heads down, you know. But the idea of sort of turning and looking to the right and left and seeing this enormous landscape that you haven't recognized, that you don't even know it's there, that's shocking. And shock is a close cousin of laughter. We used all the old music hall stuff, you know. If it was available, we used it. But I think the intention was always to try and find out something. If you know, we wouldn't sit down and say, here's a situation that'll get a laugh. We'd sit down and say, what is it that happens when you do this? You know, like, you know, when you go for a job interview, what's that about? You know, what happens to your spirit, to your psyche, what happens psychologically? You know, and we'd generally explore things because we didn't understand them, and we wanted to get in and have fun with it. So, you know, I think that's what it was like when it was at its best. And you know, those kinds of collaborations don't come along very often in your life. I mean, that was really rare. Basically, the front lawn had a natural shelf life because it didn't work when we did it into microphones. It didn't work to try and make the venues bigger. So when we did a New Zealand tour, we'd do 10-night seasons in 400-seat theatres. And as we got more popular, the only thing you could do is extend the runs so that you're doing 12-night and 15-night seasons. And it was kind of obvious we couldn't just keep doing that because it's just pretty exhausting to do that. So to move to a bigger audience, then the natural thing would be to make films. So we made the short films that we made. And then the idea of TV came up. But after about a year, we both realised our hearts weren't in it. I was writing songs in my spare time. Harry was really keen to get into directing his own stuff. So it was sort of inevitable that we'd separate and head off on our own paths at that stage. I'd been away from the band scene for about 6 years, because that was pretty much how long the front lawn lasted, and it was a full-time job for 6 years, and I'd really, you know, I hadn't been into a sweaty pub, you know, standing on stage, so I was keen to know what it felt like, and sort of complete the circle that I'd kind of started on with Blam Blam Blam, that I'd broken in 82, whenever it was. I had started really tentatively trying to get some songs together with David Long, who had played on the Front Lawn album, and the Six Volts, the band that David was in, was drawing to a close in Wellington. He wanted to change the scene, so he moved to Auckland. We worked occasionally together, just trying to get songs going. I wasn't going at any great clip. I was writing quite slowly. It still seemed possible that we might get more Front Lawn projects underway. I was pretty consumed at that stage also with the Watershed Theatre. I was part of the founding group for that, so I was really I was kind of split. I think I might have been doing some film scores as well to keep food on the table. But we auditioned drummers, David and I. We ended up with playing a first gig on St. Patrick's Day 1991 with a stand-in drummer. But eventually I'd heard that Ross Burge was living in New York and could be persuaded to come home, you know, if he liked the music. So I sent him a tape, and I hadn't ever met him. I'd just heard some records that he played on, and a lot of my friends in Wellington and the Northland and said, this is the player that you need. It was a strange period because, like, I'd been, the front line had been, you know, I suppose we'd lived reasonably well for a while because we knew that we could get around New Zealand and we could play to thousands of people. We'd got pretty well known, and that had all fallen apart. We were doing something that most of the people that I knew that were anything connected with the industry were very skeptical of. The kind of band that we had was not what was fashionable at that time. The kind of songs that we were writing were much more crafted as songs, and much less of a kind of primal scream than what was cool then, or even as now, actually. And we were rehearsing in a garage in amongst all the car yards in above Newton Gully in Auckland. And it felt grim. It felt like a bit of a backward step, but it felt... I mean, musically it felt good. Musically it was... It felt like a good thing to do, but it didn't feel like a very good career move for any of us, really, until we started gigging. And I think that first year of gigging, where we went around the country playing as a three-piece, partly being a three-piece too, I think made it kind of difficult because unless you're all really wonderful players, the three-piece can be quite a minimal experience, and it's pretty hard work for the person in the three-piece that isn't the wonderful player. And unfortunately, that was me, because I'd elected to play bass and sing, and nobody should ever do that. Sting can do it, but he's Sting. So we did that, and it felt like a bit of a lost cause for that first year. We had people saying really nice things about the songs, but it looked a bit like a hobby band. I think it was probably when we put something on record first. I think that was when we really sort of worked out who we were. We put out Dominion Road, and on the back of it we put out White Valiant, which is another one of these Fear of the Countryside things. You're from the family. That atmosphere and that sense of otherness that song's got, or the way we played it, has got the sort of brooding quality that it's got. It just didn't sound like anybody else. It didn't make us all of a sudden a new band in the sense that the other young bands were around New Zealand at the time. It didn't make us suddenly valid in terms of the small number of people who write about new, in inverted commas, music in New Zealand. But I don't think we were ever going to be a part of that. I don't think we were ever... I think we were always going to be viewed with some suspicion by people who pride themselves on being at the cutting edge of music, just simply because we're older. I'm older, and I'm even older now, and I've done other things. So, you know, it didn't immediately pull us into the fold that we'd left, or that I'd left when I left Blam Blam Blam. If I was ever in the fold, I mean, I was probably always. God knows. I mean, I don't think I'm really an insider in that way, you know, because I've always sort of followed my instincts and tended to jump the wrong way compared with everybody else. So obviously we were trucking around New Zealand, we were touring in Australia a bit. I haven't really summed up Salty as an album. I think it's a development of the first album. You know, it goes in lots of different directions at once. It's not as focused as the first record, but it's got some really good stuff on it. I think Too Close to the Sun is and Wellington's really good. You know, Alan's song Wellington and Anchor Me's on Salty, and I think that's good. At the edges of pop music, there's what we do, and pop music is a big enough and complex enough thing to accommodate a band like us, and I think that there'll be a. I think somewhere there will be. There already is, and there will be. It will grow a really dedicated following for what we do, and you know there'll be other bands imitating what we do. And there'll be people who've bought our records that are really proud to have them in 10 years' time, and that's really what it's about. I mean, it's got nothing to do with the centre of pop music, which is that sort of surface image based thing. I mean, it's ironic that a band as little interested in image as us, kind of washed up in that didn't sound very good. Ended up, shall I say, in the UK, which is. Which has got such a fickle sort of industry. I think probably we were really miserable buggers for the first year in the UK. I think we had premonitions that the whole record company thing was going to fall apart at some point. And even though we were in a good position to really sort of sprint away with it, and we were in a sort of dream position in terms of lots of bands. I mean, to be on a major label in a new country. To be doing interviews with big newspapers in England about your little life. I mean, that's pretty amazing. As it happened, it was we weren't very healthy as a group. You know, we weren't communicating very well, and we were very pessimistic about the whole thing about how it was all going to turn out, and. I wasn't writing very much, and the stuff I was writing was quite miserable. And you know, some of the best stuff on Envy of Angels is that very late at night, full of fear for the future sort of writing. And some of it works. I mean, because you know, so if you should write about what you're feeling, and that's what I was feeling at that time. Letters Home was a phrase that I tended to use about Envy of Angels. Because just looking at it, there's a song for my son, there's a song for my dad, there's a song for my nephew. It just seems to be kind of one-to-one type stuff, and that sort of characterised it. I guess I was really unwilling to write about anything in England. You know, people in England can sing about hedgerows and about oak trees and about the number 221 bus. And when they use those words, they echo inside them in a way that means something. And if I was to do that, it would just be stuck on, I think. I don't find myself writing about much in England. I've got a song on the go that has the image of the tube in it, the train station underground, I don't know. It's difficult. Every time I sort of start singing it, I wonder whether it's really me singing, because I guess it's when I look at a bus stop in New Zealand, I'm looking at the bus stop. I'm looking at what might be happening at the bus stop right now, but I'm also looking at the times I was waiting at that bus stop when I was six, and the time when I was 16 when I spray painted No Tour on that bus stop, you know, and misspelled it. What do? I sit down and I think about what I'm feeling, and I write it down, and it turns into a song. And then in a relatively short space of time, I'm standing in front of a whole lot of strangers with a guitar on, and I'm telling them about it. And if it resonates with them, if it hooks up somewhere with something that they've felt, then that's really achieved something. And the best moments are when somebody comes up to you after a gig and says, you know, that song crystallized something that I've been feeling, you know, and that's wonderful when that can happen. And the way I tend to do that is by trying to just write about people that I know, write letters to people, or try to unpick a moment that I've lived through. And either tell the story in the first person or make up some characters who then tell the story in their own words, and by using what they don't say as much as what they do say, try and paint their world in a song. And you know, songs are wonderful for that, because you can have somebody saying something that contradicts the music, or you can have the music contradicting. You can have somebody saying something quite positive or quite optimistic, and then the music is floating along pessimistically in the background. And in the gap between those two things, you've got some tension. And you know, that when that works, it's really it's really good. I'm actually finding with this new stuff that's coming out now, which is like the after Envy of Angels, it's the whole batch of songs that I'm writing now. They're more redemptive. They're more they seem to be more about people connecting, more about love, and more about hope. And I with the support of the band, I sort of came through that period of not really feeling like writing and writing grim stuff when I did write. I've come through that to now, where I'm writing a lot, and we're all really looking forward to the next record, and we're going to record it pretty quickly, but ourselves in a more sort of home-based recording way, moving around to different garages, different small studios, and finishing it sort of at our own pace. And then I would say it'll be ready by about June. Yeah. And we're trying to sort of make stuff more often now. There was a big gap between the first album and Salty because we were trying to find a record deal. There was a big gap between Salty and Envy of Angels because we had found a record deal, but we'd relocated to England, and we were touring an enormous amount, and we should have been writing and making new and recording new songs, but we were sitting in the back of a transit van in Prague somewhere. And where we're at now, even though we're not involved with Virgin anymore, we've still got the platform that they built for us, and we've still got some albums in us, better ones than we've made, I think. And that's what matters to us.